the top players and legends to the very best analysts around the world from wherever the beautiful game is played. This is BTP. Now, we're talking football.
Well, I'm finally here, and I'm finally doing something that was pending, because this is a guy I wanted to talk to for a while. I kind of exchange words here and there with him on occasion through the social medias, through the Twitters, and all that other good stuff that we have going on. And a guy that always intrigued me, and when it comes to as far as analysis, as far as football, you don't need to be around a long time as an analyst to get a good idea. Sometimes time maybe ends up jading you a bit, but with this guy, he's really made an impact and made it quickly. I'm talking about Hercules Gomez. He's with ESPN now, a guy that's been former U.S. national team, MLS Cup winner with the Seattle Sounders, has also won Copa MX, has also been amongst some of the best teams in Liga MX. Herc, man, awesome to talk to you, man. How you been?
I'm doing well, Juan. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you, man. Look, first of all, tell me about this. I mean, guy from Vegas ends up making it big. I mean, tell me how football in Vegas is like. Obviously, there's a big Mexican community in Las Vegas, but you're not originally from Vegas. You were like from California. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, I was born in Los Angeles, and I grew up in Ventura County and Oxnard for a bit until I was almost about, I believe, 10 years old. And my father had always had, he was always a businessman trying to do things here and there, and the economy went sour around 94, and I must have been 9 or 10, and it was just pretty much, I'm the oldest of five, so it was like 7 of us, my parents and us kids, everything we owned, like in a van, and out to Vegas, start over. I got to Vegas, and it was my first summer. It was like 124 degrees, and I was a Cali boy, but I'd never experienced a sunburn. So that was interesting, and just immediately once I got there, I got to realize how rich of a soccer community it was. And you said, look, a rich Mexican community, but all over. My best friends growing up were El Salvadorian. I played on El Salvadorian teams. I used to play on the team. I used to help out this men's league team every once in a while called Guanacos. It was a rich Salvadoran tradition for this part of town, and it got me to realize that there was more outside just the Mexican community, how big Vegas actually was. Everybody thinks Vegas is only just that 3-mile stretch of land, that strip with the casinos. It's so much more than that, and it was a good experience that it got me to realize how big actually everything outside of my own little world was.
I mean, you say your own little world, but I mean, what was your own little world? It was just, you talk about California, you just talked about like your inner circle within Las Vegas at that point.
Oh, my own little world was just, pretty much soccer. It was whatever club team I was playing for, whether it was California or it was Vegas. I didn't venture outside of that. I was very naive when I was younger. I was a late bloomer. I was a late bloomer in my career. I was a late bloomer in life as well. I could probably tell you the day I hit puberty. I didn't care for girls when I was in high school. It wasn't until my junior and senior year where I started thinking of things other than soccer, seeing the world outside for just soccer. I used to wear, soccer shirts and shorts and didn't care about my appearance. I had crazy long curly hair. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until soccer was just fun. It was never, I had to prepare. I was just kind of got by with it. And it wasn't until I was older that I realized there was a lot of things I needed to refine about not only my game but my outlook on life.
Just by you saying that at 16 you started to like girls, something I'm like, man, something wrong with this dude. I mean, I'm like, what? 16? It took you until 16 to figure that part out? Oh my God, where were you? Poor guy. What were you missing out on?
But that's a good question.
But everyone has their story, and it, to me that's interesting, because I myself had to deal with a lot of players when I played. Obviously, I didn't play to the extent that you did, and nowhere I'm trying to compare it in the same galaxy as that. But I had to deal with a lot of players that it was just soccer. It was just that. I mean, and I'm like, dude, this girl looks pretty good. And I guess that was part of the problem why I couldn't progress, because, I was like, I get sidetracked too easily. But that's another story for another time. But so I mean, that helped you from a playing standpoint, didn't it? I mean, it, being able to experience that Salvadorian, the adult league culture that is not just in Las Vegas, but throughout many communities in the United States. Did that help you as a player to kind of see things a little bit differently when you took the next step and eventually all the steps after that?
You know what I think helped me immensely in my young upbringing as a, not only an adult, but or as an adolescent, not only as an adolescent, but as a footballer, was I would play club soccer, and they had this rule. I don't know if this rule even exists anymore, but I would play club soccer pretty much year-round until high school soccer was on. And for those 2.5-3 months, I would go play high school soccer. But I was only playing with kids my age. And it wasn't until I got into high school soccer that I realized, you know, playing against older kids made me sharper. Even if the level wasn't as great, they were more physical. They were you had to do different things to get around them. And then my dad and other men's league teams would invite me to play, and now I'm playing against men. That really gave me a different perspective. It wasn't playing against, and you know, soccer in this country is very much a middle class to upper middle class, almost white man sport. And it wasn't until I started playing against bigger kids, older kids, men, that I started refining my game. I started thinking of different ways I could be effective, because I was 4'11", 84 pounds my freshman year. I didn't hit a growth spurt until that junior year that I'm talking to you about. Mm-hmm. So I was very much always a smaller kid. So in order to be effective playing against bigger opponents and smarter opponents, because, I mean, you're playing against men now, I had to do different things. I had to be a different player. And I think that really refined my game and just overall outlook in the game at that age.
I mean, it's interesting that you say that because of how your perspective changed, of how the vision changes and the different resources that all of a sudden you have to be able to go to have and to acquire throughout the process. But I mean, but look at the bright side. I mean, you were what, about 2 inches shorter than Nahuel Barrios, the guy from San Lorenzo who's playing in first division. He's just 5'1". So, I mean, you shouldn't feel so bad about that. I mean, you
know. Yeah, the only difference is our pedigree. He was probably playing from 10 years old and in some sort of everyday academy, mm-hmm. you know, and I was fortunate enough to be in a pay-to-play system that I didn't have to pay for. You know, I was very fortunate. I'm very one of the few that get to come out of this and say how fortunate they were. I had a guy on my club team in Vegas, and his father owned an electrical company that did electrical work for a bunch of casinos, so they were very well off. And this man, very integral part of my upbringing, because without his efforts, I probably wouldn't be where I am today, would cut a check and pretty much pay for our expenses. I was one of three Hispanic kids on the team, and he would cut a check and pay for expenses, so every month we can go on these different tourneys outside of Las Vegas. And my club team, when we were U15s, U17s, we were always playing years up, you know, to get these games, because in that time, Southern Nevada didn't have the talent it does today. So we had to travel to get any type of competition. And that, I guess, those experiences of being on a traveling team, which at that point was as good as it got, really helped me. But without that, you know, I wouldn't have been so fortunate. So I was fortunate in that sense. But like I said, not many have that same fortune.
You know, you're right. I mean, I totally get that, because that was, you know, one of the things that when I've talked to either former teammates or people that I've you know, worked with at one time or another that were striving to become either, I mean, at that time, you know, 1990, you know, early to mid 90s, you're not really, you know, at least the goal here in the United States wasn't to be a professional footballer. Maybe until MLS started coming around, that kind of changed a little bit. But at that point, it was just, you know, hey, let me go to college. Let me see what I can do, get an education, and maybe something will happen in the future. I mean, but now, in your case, you're at this point, you're traveling team, maybe even a couple of ODP tryouts here and there. When is the first time that you really get noticed to be able to take that next step forward? When was that first instance? Do you remember how that worked out and how that ended up being?
Well, I'll tell you this. The first time I realized soccer was a little political and different in this country was when I knew I was good enough to play ODP, but I didn't have the money to pay for it. I didn't have the money for the one-day $100 mini camp. You know, the best players in my city didn't play ODP. It was the rich kids. And that's when I realized that if I wanted to make it in soccer, I'd either have to go the collegiate route or I'd have to go elsewhere. And it wasn't until my junior year, club and high school, that I just started getting noticed on my team, in my city. I was never the best player, you know, in the city, but I would get recognized as a decent player. And my senior year of high school, man, I had a really good year at club. I had a really good year at high school. I started taking soccer on as a religion. You know, I would wake up early, go train, go to school, you know, train after, go to work, and didn't do it all over again. And then when it was club soccer and we had off days, because it was only like train Tuesday, Thursday, you know, every other day, I'm training. Weekends when we don't have a game, I'm getting my buddies together and we're going out to the only park that had a goal and a net. And we got a keeper, we're running some drills, I'm training. You know, instead of buying, I guess, other things high school kids bought, I would buy, you know, I would buy soccer balls, I would buy cones, I would buy, you know, cleats, all these other things, or I would play Sunday league so they can give me these things. That's when I started realizing how just much I wanted it. And then when I didn't have these big schools knocking on my door, and here I am winning like state cups and all these things, and my high school's going far, and you know, tourneys and all this, that's when I realized, like, maybe if I want to continue this or pursue this, I have to leave. And that's what I did. I ended up having to leave the United States at a very early age and you know, press my luck in Mexico. I was 18 when I left, and I tried out for this team called Pachuca. You know, I grew up watching Pachuca, and that was like their heyday when I went to go try out for them. I mean, you talk about Pachuca's heyday with Damian Alvarez, with Calero, with Chaco Jimenez, you know, with all these crazy historic, just monumental figures that came out of that club that made that club, you know, one of the biggest clubs in Mexico at that time. Here I go and I try out for the third division team, and I realize how little I knew about the game, how little I knew about life, how minute I was in pedigree compared to everybody else. And things didn't go well at Pachuca, but they went well enough for a guy who was there. We played some exhibition game in the 2 weeks I was there, and he was watching one of his nephews, or I don't even know what it was, and we got to talking, and he had connections at Cruz Azul, and I literally went to Cruz Azul, and for a whole season I got to spend everyday life there in the Casa Club and with the second division team, and mm-hmm. I would stay in the facilities, all that, you know, mm-hmm. got to eat there, all these other things, but I was pretty much a training dummy. I trained for a whole season, and it was pretty much thank you for this. And mm-hmm. because of the training for a whole season there, a bunch of kids kind of heard about this trial going on, this new team that was forming in this city called Puebla, and went down as a new second division team, and I made the team. And that's pretty much how it started. I spent, I want to say, a year and a half tops in Mexico. In the Fuerzas Básicas, nothing crazy. It was an experience, that was for sure. And I came back to the United States. I had a kind of, it was mm-hmm. an experience, to put it that. It was neither good nor bad. It was just an experience. I learned a lot. When I came back to the U.S., I was kind of burnt out. You know, it wasn't getting me anywhere. I mean, the contract that I had was 400 pesos mensuales, and in that time it could have been, I mean, I think the exchange rate was maybe 10-1. Yeah,
so you're talking like about 40 bucks a month.
40 bucks a month, and you know, they're housing me and they're feeding me, so it's not too bad, and yeah. I'm getting to play a game for a living. But it just, I didn't see I didn't see an exit strategy or an end game. So I came back to the United States and, you know, I was burnt out and a buddy of mine, ready to kind of give up on it. And a buddy of mine saw a fire or something in Vegas for tryouts for a USL team that was starting up in San Diego. And I was like, man, I don't want to go. And we, you know, kind of forced me. We went and it was like the worst thing I've ever seen. It was like 300 people. It was like 300 people on two soccer fields. I mean, they must have made it. I don't know what they charged me. I think I paid my $50 registration fee and took a number got in, you know. And it was like they were weeding these guys out. It was, they started with fitness, so the flies would drop. You know, the flies were falling. And you know, from there we started doing soccer. And I was one of the youngest guys probably there. I was 19. Long story short, I made the team. I was sleeping on floors with teammates and whatnot, but I got to, you know, practice every day and then play on this USL club that was traveling, and it was in San Diego. I had the time of my life, and it gave me like a, you know, renewed lease kind of on my soccer life. And because of that, we played an exhibition game against the Galaxy, and I did well, scored a goal, and, you know, after my season, you know, 2 weeks later, I signed with the Galaxy, and then 3 months later, we win MLS Cup, and that's just kind of how my career took off.
Yeah, I mean that part to me, that part of your career is so compelling. Having to go to Mexico, and had you ever been to Mexico before? I mean, even on vacation or just visiting family, or was it something that, you know, just completely blew your mind as far as the experience itself? I mean, how were you that first time that you stepped over in Pachuca, and you're like, oh my God, what am I doing here? Do I belong here? Did you ever have that in your head?
Yeah, I felt very much gringo. I felt like a gringo. I didn't know what was going on. It was a huge culture shock for me. Yeah. I come from a very working class family. Both my parents were always at work. And I don't want to say we were left to fend for ourselves, but you know, everybody kind of had to do their own thing and pull their own weight. So it wasn't like we were taking, you know, family vacations and doing these things and going to exotic places or even going back to my parents' homeland. So my first experiences with Mexico were like Tijuana, Mexicali, you know, things like that. It wasn't like I really knew Mexico. So when I got to a place like Pachuca,
it wasn't like your family was going to Cancun or anything like that for, you know, spending a week.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So when I got to Pachuca, which is kind of a, I don't want to say dreary city, but it's not even a city, it's a town.
Yeah.
And it's not the most aesthetically pleasing in Mexico. And this is now. When you went back then, I mean, wow, that was even worse. I mean, because of what Pachuca, the club, is now, they at least have a few things. But back then, it was really a culture shock. I was like, what did I get myself into?
Yeah, I can only imagine.
Yeah, you know what the worst part was, Juan? The hardest thing for me was, I grew up in a Mexican-American, you know, environment and culture, and with my mom speaks, you know, she speaks very well. Her English is great. You know, she speaks it very well. My dad with us would refuse to speak English, so he'd force us to speak Spanish with them. And
are you sure like your dad wasn't my dad? I mean, he lied to you that he was Mexican instead of Colombian. It sounds like my dad. That's why I kind of like feel what you're saying every time.
I feel like many Hispanic Americans, their parents are the same way. They're one of your parents thinks you're losing touch with your roots, so they refuse to speak to you in a different language. They want to force you to use that language. Mm-hmm. So I always understood everything in Spanish, but you know, como me daba pena, like I would be embarrassed to speak Spanish with my dad. Yeah. And then when I went to Mexico, it was like, listen, man, nobody speaks English, you know? So get with the program, and it really refined the language for me, and I came back so much better for it, you know, and to this day, it's one of the things I'm most grateful for, was that I took that leap of faith, and I kind of immersed myself in that culture, and I learned so much about my culture and about my family that I didn't know before. I didn't have those opportunities before, and one of the things that I'm really grateful for was that type of experience.
Hurt, let me ask you, man. I mean, your dad. How was he? How was he the type of dad? I'm just trying to see, because, you know, trying to use my dad as a reference in a way. I mean, was he like, you know, yeah, we're in America, but inside my house, this is you know, Mexico, or in my case, this is not the United. When you're inside my house, you're not in America anymore. We run things differently in this house. Was he like that a little bit, or how did that work out?
It wasn't this is Mexico. It was this is the United States of Gomez. it was his way. You know, he was definitely more authoritarian with us. He was he expected things. I'm sure many would relate. It was very difficult for me to talk to my parents about it. I mean, I was the oldest, so it wasn't like I had somebody else to kind of learn from. You know, it was trial and error for me, and then my brothers and sisters would learn, all right, we can't do this, or we can do this, we can get away with this, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Don't be like her. Look what her did.
One of the few things we had to kind of bond with, or I had to bond with my dad, was the game, was soccer.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of all my life lessons I took from him revolved around the game. So it was interesting. And I see a lot now with other parents where they feel their kids are losing touch of the struggle of what it took to get them there, and how blessed they are and how privileged they are, and how maybe if you were in different countries, you wouldn't have the same opportunities. And I didn't understand those things growing up. And it took me leaving to really understand and appreciate how much my parents had done for me.
Was there a moment when you had that confirmed? Was there like a moment in your youth or even in your professional career when you had that bond with your dad and you said, yeah, I get it. I get what he's been telling me. But then mostly also that confirmed the football bond between your dad and yourself. Was there one particular moment that you just kind of mentally sat back and said, damn, you know, this is cool?
You know, I remember my dad. There was this soccer camp I really wanted to go to. It had nothing to do with club or anything. All my buddies were going, and I really wanted to go. And it was like $350. And you would get a week stay in this university, and you would be coached by, you know, top level athletes. I later come to realize they weren't top level athletes; they were college kids who were camp counselors at the soccer camp. You know, but all my buddies were going, and I really wanted to go. And I've been telling my dad, you know, for almost a month, and he told me he'd get me the money. He told me he'd get me the money, and you know, you're a young kid, and you have no idea the value of money. And it's almost time, and you know, my dad still hasn't given me the money. And I swear, I mean, we're about to leave, and literally like bus is about to take off, me and all my teammates, and I'm waiting there, and my dad comes in last minute and he hands me the money. And I was really appreciative, and I said thank you and all that. And I went to the soccer camp, and I learned a lot. It was a great experience. And it wasn't until later I got older that I started asking myself, where did he get that money? Like, I look back at how things were, and it probably wasn't like something he had offhand. And it always made me wonder, you know, how did he get this? What, you know, my dad was a type, but you know, he probably wouldn't tell me to this day. But he got me the money, and it gave me a great experience. And later on, I'm playing for Puebla. And I had this kind of dream season, this dream scenario where I came out of nowhere and I was scoring goals. I ended up winning the goal scoring title in Mexico. And my parents, you know, I got to, because of the experience, I got to fly them out because I was doing well. And they came to Puebla and they came to watch me play. And it was literally the first time either of them had been back to Mexico in like 30, 40 years to see their son play. And they came to like four games, and I must have scored like five goals. And I remember having dinner with my parents and just kind of that flashing back with me, you know, like holy shit.
I get it. Yeah,
you know, it was kind of like a coming to moment, which was really cool. And it was great that my parents got to be there for that, but it was like a all kind of coming together moment.
I mean, and I remember that time in your career because, I mean, you were making a lot of headlines, at least stateside. I mean, your parents must have told you that. but you know, say, hey, you know, look, hey, Hercules Gomez is a leading goal scorer in the Mexican league. Oh, look, a gringo's a, you know, leading goal scorer. Wow, you know, what's the world coming to? But some say, hey, you know, great guy to do it. You know, that wonderful time that you had at Puebla. But at the same time, who was the coach at that time? Was it Osorio? I'm trying to remember.
No, it was Chelis.
Chelis, yes, it was Chelis. Well, Chelis in his, what, his 15th time at Puebla, which one was it, or his 16th? I'm not exactly sure.
That was one of the first go-arounds. That's when he still had the Chelis boys, and the team was like this mythical, like, you know, just Mexican spirit team where they didn't have the main, I guess, headline players, but as a team, you know, they're a great unit and just kind of, you know, did things. It was crazy.
What a character he is. I mean, I've had the pleasure to speak to Chelis, and I've also had a pleasure to follow him, albeit a brief time here in Major League Soccer. I mean, the impact that he had was amazing, both for negative and positive reasons. But I mean, how was he as a coach? I mean, everybody who's familiar with El Chelis knows his personality, his mystique, but very few talk about what he's able to do as far as football smarts are concerned.
You know, it's funny. And I'll give it some context really quick. Mm-hmm. But I remember growing up, my dad said he loved me playing club soccer con los Americanos because it was so organized. It was something he said that was lacking on our side of the game. And, it, you know, I didn't realize until I started playing men's league what he was talking about. You were free to express yourself in men's league, but it was kind of disorganized and it was more like street soccer, whereas in the club soccer it was formations and organizations and structure. So I'd been exposed to those things, you know, growing up. And then I go and I play for Chelis, and it was just like off the wall. it was one day we're all wearing like wolf masks, you know, we're playing soccer in wolf masks, wolf masks. And it was like the other day we're warming up and there's a reggaeton playing in the background because Chelis wants us to be in a good mood. And there's the next day where, you know, if you win this competition, Chelis is giving, you know, gifting you a big screen, like a 56-inch big screen. You're like, what is going on? And then sometimes, you know, he would throw caution to the wind and it'd be like an all-out attack fest. It was just so random. Nothing before it would prepare me for this. But it all kind of had meaning and it was all for a greater good in his mind. And I really appreciated that he was about making the group a family. And the more of these good moments and bad moments you go through with people, the closer you get. And I'll tell you what, a lot of those players weren't the best players, maybe in Mexican League soccer, but they were the best players for Chelis. Every single one of these guys on this team would have ran through a wall for Chelis. That's how dedicated they were to him. And when you have that many players with a belief and blind just dedication or devotion to a cause, that's dangerous. I mean, that could be a good danger.
It's a tremendous danger for sure. I mean, if you're on the right side of that danger, of course. I mean, you talk about all the good things and all the negative things. And I asked you earlier of how you felt the first time you were in Mexico. The second time when you came back, what was the shock as much? Or was it that you at one point, you still kind of, you know, you're totally comfortable, or were you like a bit uncomfortable knowing at the level in which you were playing at that moment? You were playing for a Puebla side that was doing well. Of course, you come back to Pachuca at one point. I think you played briefly with Tecos, right?
Yeah. So this is the second when I got to Puebla, my first go around in Mexico, I was very naive to the world. I'd never been on my own, you know, like many Latin American kids. Like, my parents didn't let me do sleepovers. They didn't, you know, so it was like I'm on my own for the first time. I'm in charge of my own schedule. I have to worry about what I eat for myself, my, you know, my well-being, all that. The second go around, I'm a little less naive to not only Mexico but to the world, and I'm not immune to that country's problems. Like, now I can see this country was having problems. It was in 2010 when I got there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Mexico has long been fighting, you know, this drug war. And, you know, an outsider's perspective, it's very scary. And it's very scary for people who live there who are affected by it. But not the whole country lives under those same, I want to say, insecurities. Not insecurities, but
yeah, the same fears.
Same fears, same factors, yes.
Yeah, I mean, so I totally get you, yeah.
And so I get there, and now I understand what's going on in this country, and I'm like, but this is a great opportunity. Look, I had this thing didn't work out in the MLS. This contract didn't work out. I have to go here. I have to do this. A six-month contract, you know, my mindset was literally get out. You know, whatever happens for it'll be for a greater good. You know, you'll be better for it after you finish this contract. It'll be on your resume. You played in, you know, Liga MX or Mexico. So I get there. And I'm already kind of nervous because of what the country's going through. And I get there, and I'm reassured that nothing's going on. These places that these teams are at aren't affected. These aren't things that affect, like, you know, footballers and all these things. And I remember one of the first days that I'm in Puebla and I'm going to training. I'm taking a taxi from the hotel to El Estadio Cuauhtémoc, to the stadium.
Yeah.
And the taxi driver has the radio on, and they start talking about how Salvador Cabañas has just been shot in the head at Barbar. And this is the biggest player in Mexico, Paraguayan International, America, Club America, like Starlet. And he's just been shot in the head, and he's in critical condition. And I'm sitting here going, like, I just saw this guy play, like, last night. What's going on? Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was crazy. I mean, that story just blew everybody's mind, yeah.
And I'm like, what did I just get myself into? And I'm freaking out. And that really kind of, I mean, it scared me. And I get the training, and everybody's talking about it, and I can't believe what's going on. And this is, now it's me. You know, I very much feel like, what did I just get myself into? And as time went on and as things surfaced with that story, you realized that it was more personal matters and things of that nature with him and people he was involved with. And it wasn't like everyday security matters. And as the longer I went in Mexico, the more I started seeing how beautiful of a country it is and how great the people were, how, yes, these things are happening, but they're happening in certain areas and for certain reasons that I won't get into. But
No, sorry. I'm not gonna let you go like that. You know what do you mean? I'm not gonna go into.
I'm kidding.
I'm messing with you.
Yeah. Well, what I mean is, I realized how yes, there are parts like any country that they have things that they need to solve. They have problems they need to solve.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like I was, you know, in the middle or exposed to all these things. I was very fortunate. I never once felt unsafe in my time in Mexico. I had a great experience. But yes, getting there was definitely a culture shock for me in many ways.
Yeah. I've been in Mexico, and I have stories of, you know, I mean, I could tell you whatever next time we talk about me driving through Tepito and not knowing what Tepito is.
Yeah,
I mean, once you see it, you're like, oh my goodness. And people, when I went to Pachuca, I said, yeah, I took this highway, or I took this road. He goes, dude, you just drove through Tepito and you're still alive. And once they say that, it's just like a cold sweat just invades your skin, your entire body. And you're like, what do you mean? What did I just do? If I tell you the entire story, you're like, what an idiot. I mean, I'm glad you're still alive, but how are you still alive? But I mean, but again, those are things that much like your experience, I've kind of seen that with a lot of people in other cultures as well, kind of telling people, especially here in the States. No, I mean, just because you hear about Colombia being in bad shape or Mexico being in bad shape doesn't mean that every single corner and every single city is a war zone. And I think that's where the context of it all ends up being kind of, like, for lack of a better term, ends up being, you know, exaggerated to a certain extent. And in your case, so much so that you ended up meeting your wife in Mexico, correct? Or did you meet her here in the States?
I met her in Mexico. I was, you know, I was in Santos now, and I signed my contract with Santos, and I was scheduled to be there for my physical on the 26th of December. Mm-hmm. So spent Christmas alone by myself in Guadalajara. Flew out the next morning, the 26th, The only flight from Guadalajara to Torreon, which is like a 7:15 a.m. flight, got to Torreon, did my physical, and it was preseason and just soccer and didn't see a lot of Torreon. And then when we finally got back from preseason, ended up being a thing where one of the first friends I actually made in Torreon was my wife. It was, I think, February.
How was that? I mean, you say, hey, hi, my name's Herc, and she's like, oh, I know. I mean, how does that work out?
Well, she used to work for Televisa, and it just so happens that, you know, she was doing a report on, like, one of the new recruits, mm-hmm. and, like, her and a bunch of camera crews and other reporters, they actually came to the house, and we got talking, we kind of hit it off, and we ended up living, I want to say, quarter of a mile from each other. She ended up living like the next neighborhood over. So we ended up, you know, being in this group of friends that would always hang out. And it was just us being friends, and then just kind of, you know, grew into more. But it was cool. I had somebody for like the first time in Mexico that was, a friend like that. That was, I can go to and share things with that. I wanted to see, more and more of, and it helped that, I did well at Santos. It helped that it was all positive experience for me. I didn't have any negative experiences in Santos, so that went, you know, really well, and we grew closer as friends, closer as a couple, and then when I got sold to Cholos, I told her I didn't do long distance, and she was kind of sad, and I was like, but I really want you to come back with me, and, you know, come live with me, and she took kind of like a leap of faith because she had her own career going and all that stuff, and she came to live with me, and, you know, not too long after that we got engaged.
Because that relationship, I mean, it looks so cool, because you obviously you kind of live vicariously through other people by seeing how they live based on the pictures that they take. It's not trying to say that you're fancy or anything like that. It's just, you know, how you live your life and how you really have come to transmit the joy of what you have. And one of the things with what you have is a relationship with your wife. And of course, nothing more kind of exemplifies it. Every time the U.S. and Mexico play, I always see at least one picture or one video of you and your wife. She has her Mexico jersey on. You have your U.S. jersey on. And, you know, it just gives that little bit more of spice that really is enjoyable to watch. It's kind of refreshing to watch in a relationship. I mean, how does that work out when U.S. play Mexico? Is it that you guys talk to each other, or are you guys kind of like, I mean, is there a little bit of a, you know, a little bit of a pica there at one point or another?
Yeah, you know, we give each other a stick. It's all in good fun. Cool. You know, that's the thing. It doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter who you are in Mexico. You're a fan of the game. You're a fan of your national team. You know, it's something you take pride in. And I found out very quickly how cool that kind of culture is, that dynamic is with the fans and their team, and how proud and they are of not, you know, not only a team, but just of being Mexican. You know, it's un orgullo for them, you know, it's something crazy. So for me to kind of get that experience being over there and being American was really cool. But it, you know, my friends down there will always have like a good back and forth. My wife isn't the exception. You know, she likes to rub it in if it doesn't go well for the U.S., just like I'll like to rub it in for her if it doesn't go well, but it's all in good fun. We enjoy watching the games together. That's the cool thing about my wife is she enjoys the game. So when I'm sitting here and I have to, you know, per se do work and study film and watch a game, you know, she sits down and watches it with me. She has her own opinions about players, and they're very much not like mine. So it's a good perspective.
I think that's phenomenal. I think that, but she was just a regular beat reporter, or she just did sports for Televisa.
She did weather and she did color on games. You know, she would do color as far as like being in the stands, talking mm-hmm. to the fans, and all just the overall fan experience, all that stuff. But yeah, she definitely knows her way around the business. She's incredibly talented, smart girl. So it actually helps me now, because there's things that I don't know about the business that she'll give me a heads up for, or things that when I come and complain to her about how something is, she's like, yep, welcome to the biz, you know?
Yeah. Hey, them weather girls, they always get you, don't they? but it's always good to have somebody like that around, because they kind of, you know, especially what you're doing now, it kind of gives you a better education or a quicker education into what you're doing. And it was also a good time for you. You know, you meet her, you end up being in Torreon, you win the league title in Torreon, and you end up even getting into a CONCACAF Champions League final. Of course, you played that Monterrey side that was just amazing, and kind of leave you on the wayside. But overall, Mexico was phenomenal for you. Then you go back to Toronto. Tell me about that.
Well, Toronto was difficult. I was coming off a contract dispute with Cholos, so I was inactive for about maybe three months, and you know, I was coming off a bit of some knee issues, so I could never get really going with Toronto. And by the time I did start getting going, we're out of playoffs. So I come back the next season, and I'm doing my best to hit the ground running. And I was a player that they pretty much wanted to get off their books. They didn't see me starting, so they didn't want to have a high salary cap just kind of sitting on the bench. And if they can get me off their books, they can use that money elsewhere. And they had other, you know, pending issues or things they wanted to get to. And the way it kind of went about left a sour taste in my mouth, but it's over now. And because it happened, the door opened, you know, for Seattle. It was a team that I always had a good rapport with. I played many years in CONCACAF Champions League and had a good rapport with the fans, you know, good back and forth, good banter. So when it came about, you know, I didn't hesitate. I said, yes, this is where I want to go. And it was really, really refreshing for my wife and I. You know, my wife and I, no kids, heading into a new city. It was an adventure for us. So we went to Seattle and we, you know, we had a lot of fun. We really, really enjoyed the city, our teammates, you know, we enjoyed everything about the team, the culture, the fan experience. Mm-hmm. I've been in some big teams in Mexico. I've played in some big venues. I've seen good fan bases, bad fan bases, and Seattle's fan base, you know, it rivals all these great experiences. So I was sold on it immediately.
Wait, I'm trying to get the timing here of when you got to Seattle. Was it more like in the summer, like June, July, more or less, or was it a little bit earlier than that?
No, so roster freeze would have been like the first week of March.
Oh, okay, so you got even earlier than that. Okay, I'd lost it, because obviously Seattle had so many struggles. Siggy leaves at the middle of the season. You know, Coach Meltzer comes in and he ends up taking over. You guys go with the incredible run. Of course, Nico Lodeiro comes in and really, you know, sets the league on fire. But I mean, you had your role too. I mean, obviously you weren't that forward that was scoring goals. You were the one that was doing all the dirty work behind the scenes a lot of times when you were on the pitch. You were the one that was creating the pressure to, you know, find that ball for another teammate to find the ball, to create the opportunity eventually. But obviously not a lot of that's going to appear in the stat sheets, but your role was well defined there, wasn't it?
Well, I definitely had a different role. For one, you know, I wasn't even playing forward anymore. I played forward in three games. Mm-hmm. One of them was an exhibition game, and the other two were Open Cup games, you know, and I ended up scoring in all of them. So it was different. My role was, I was more of a volante or a winger or a midfielder, and it was
like
more
an extremo, pretty much.
Not even extremo. It was more like an interior. It was more like to
keep
balance and structure in a team that was we were kind of lacking that all year. You know, we had a lot of misfortune. I think I felt really bad for what happened to Siggy. Siggy never had one game day roster where he can choose from like a healthy 18 or a healthy 11. You know, for that point. Or for that matter, and who knows if Siggy's still around, we get Nico and we get Flaco and the team get strings on three or four wins like we did, if things would have been different for Siggy. Not to say that Brian, you know, Schmetzer didn't do well in his own right, but it wasn't like the team was, we weren't getting results, but it wasn't like we were far off from these results. So it was kind of weird. And my role, I would say, within that was to kind of be one of these guys that when things were going bad and people were trying to press the panic button, to kind of, you know, ease off that and calm tempers and kind of lead in different ways that were maybe not so vocal, but, you know, I'd been in situations like that before. Last time I won an MLS Cup before this time was one of the same exact situations. We had tons of talent, weren't putting together on the field, and we ended up winning a double with Steve Sampson, you know, in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I mean, Herc, that was interesting what you're saying about everything that happened in Seattle, of course. You're going to get your ring soon, aren't you?
Yeah. Mine's in the mail.
I thought they were going to say, hey, Herc, come over. We'll have a ceremony and bring you in and you have the fans carry you across like they did, when you did your celebration, you know, kind of, you know, people surf you through the stadium. I thought that would be awesome.
Yeah, they had a small, press conference, and, you know, they gave the guys their rings. It was like a small little, I shouldn't say small, but it was a ceremony midweek, so it wasn't something I could attend, especially being out here in Hartford. It'd be difficult to, you know, hop on a flight and not lose too much time to go to Seattle and then come back. So
yeah. And now that whole transition you make, I mean, how difficult was it to say after, you know, almost 15 years, almost 20, if you want to include, you know, your time, you know, at the youth level, I mean, to say, okay, fine, I'm done. I mean, how hard was that for you as a player, knowing how much you've done, how much you've gone, U.S. national team, you know, Copa MX, Liga MX, all those things that you did in the NMLS as well, to now finally come at a crossroads and say, okay, do I stay, do I go, and finally make that decision and be good with it?
You know, you would think after, like, it would be difficult, but after a 17-year career, it wasn't too difficult. I'm pretty prideful, and when I started seeing that I was getting the benefit of the doubt over younger guys who probably, you know, if I'm being quite frank, were more talented or more adept or could probably provide more, but me, because I had that experience per se, or that resume, was getting the benefit of the doubt over it. It made the decision easy. And plus, I was getting opportunities off the field that may have not have been there if I waited on them. I could have easily played another year, two, three, maybe lower division Mexico or lower teams in Mexico, you know, just kind of cashed off your name type of deal.
Yeah, I know of a team that would have been interested in you at that point. I mean, no ifs, ands, or buts about it. But, I mean, of course, that ends up being a very personal decision, too.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I mean, for you to be mentally, you know, ready and have the awareness to say, you know, I'm done. You know, and I'm good with it.
Yeah, it helped that I had these opportunities off the field, you know. I didn't want to, at the expense of just keep playing because I wanted to keep playing, let these opportunities pass me by. And I'm very fortunate, honestly. I had this Copa America gig that I worked with Fox, and that went well, and it translated to working FIFA fixture dates, you know, with Fox for the national team. And I was a contractor with them, which meant that I didn't have a full-time contract. It was like a per
event basis.
Yeah. And I started getting more attention from other places, from, you know, ESPN, Univision, and I had these opportunities, and I kept thinking to myself that maybe they won't be around later. You know, this is a very competitive business, and I didn't just want to keep playing to play. I wasn't going to play in another World Cup. Not every year was going to be an MLS Cup year. National team games weren't in my future anymore. So all I could wish to do, I'd done, and it felt like the right time to walk away. So it was an easy decision. I don't miss it so far, which is crazy, but I think the reason I don't miss it is because I'm still kind of immersed in the game every day. You know, I jumped right from retirement into doing something else, so this is still so fresh for me that it hasn't given me like a lot of time to sit back and reflect.
Yeah, and I, you know, that leads us to kind of like a first crossroads where we kind of cross paths, I guess you could say. And I forgot to tell you, man, I loved what you did in Copa America. I mean, we were in contact throughout the tournament.
Yeah, but you actually helped me a lot. There were a lot of South American teams that I wasn't familiar with, but you were, you know, and it was great to kind of get your feedback on a lot of these things.
Yeah, I know. And I got, because, of course, I think you were in LA at that point. I was, you know, going down the East Coast, so, you know, obviously we don't have time to sit down and have a beer or anything like that. But we, you know, say, hey, man, and I never really told you, hey, man, you know, I really liked your work, man, I really did, and I just never told you that. You know, I'm not trying to say it to kiss your ass or anything like that. I'm just trying. I'm just saying it because I sincerely did. I really liked it. I
appreciate that, honestly. Yeah. And I'll tell you what, I was asked the other day, what's the hardest part of my job, and I said, well, besides the fact that I don't know what I'm doing half the time. So I appreciate your compliment because I don't know what I'm doing half the time.
No, but you know what? I think that's the beauty of it, that we don't know what the hell we're doing at times, but we kind of figure it out. And in our profession, I don't even call it a profession. I don't even call it a job, to be honest with you. And I don't think you do either, because you know where you've been, and you know where you come from, and seeing your parents work how they did, at least from my perspective. I don't consider it a job. I kind of consider it a calling. I kind of consider it a passion that we're following through. I mean, you probably might see it that way. But what's really impressed me, and again, how I introduced you, is that you don't need a lot of time to make an impact. And I think in the past, I guess, little less than a year, I think you've been one of the guys that's really made a huge impact on how people are seeing the game in the U.S., because you're, you know, no nonsense. You're straight to the point. You're not about going in and kind of, you know, you're very straight. You're very honest with what people need to know. And if you need to, you know, rattle a few cages, you've done that. I mean, and you have a much different way than I do, of course, to get a point across. You're more kind of civil. I'm a little bit more, you know, out there. But still, I mean, that's very commendable.
I think I'm very honest with myself. Like, I'm not going to sit here and tell you MLS is the best league in the world, but it's also not the worst league in the world.
Exactly.
You know, and you and I have had some very civil back and forths about, you know, our thoughts on certain subjects or certain you know, things relating to, which I think are beneficial. I think the dialogue in our country, you know, that debate is something that needs to happen, because there's not one correct form of playing the game. Like, if you speak to somebody who's British and they tell you that the Premier League is the best league in the world, well, that's probably not my reality or your reality. Mm-hmm. You know, we have other brands of football or soccer, whatever you want to call it, that we enjoy, that we like. So because I've experienced, I guess, these two different realities or perspectives, my view or my vantage is a little different. And I don't mind saying, you know, or just what I feel. I think if you get too political, people see through that. And after a while, you know, they go elsewhere where they get a real opinion. And whether it's right or wrong, as long as it's your opinion and you really believe it. And I don't just say things to say things. If I say something, it's because I believe it.
Yeah, no, and that's quite evident. And many have said that about you, especially when it came to, I think they were talking about the whole issue of MLS expansion and how you said, guys, wait, we're getting ahead of ourselves. There's an issue that has to be settled here, and it's the issue of Miami. And you kind of put brakes on the issue, say, guys, if this doesn't come through, everything else is kind of, you know, nonsense to really be discussing. So that's what I really liked about you, that you really took it into another direction. And not only that, that I'm starting to see more Latinos in the business. I'm starting to see more Latinos representing, because, and you mentioned it before, I mean, you know, how soccer's been in this country. It's been a middle to upper class, you know, white man sport, if you will. But then the media has been as well. And it's so, to me, it's refreshing to be able to see a guy like you, a guy like Max going, a guy like Seba as well, doing his thing over at ESPN. I mean, it kind of, it's like, dude, I'm finally hearing somebody that I can relate to, that kind of sees things not the way I see them, but that I can understand, because they're coming from a background where they've seen similar things and they've been able to formulate their opinion, whether I agree with it or not.
Well, I mean, you should start seeing more people like that are in the business, you know, because it's quite frankly a demographic that a lot of these companies, a consumer, a lot of these companies are trying to reach. So it makes sense. And look, guys like me and Seba, and I shouldn't even put Seba into this equation, because Seba's been doing this. Sebastian Salazar, he's been doing this since he was like 16, 17, you know, and but we're fresh onto the scene, but this guy's been chipping away for a while. But like guys like you and Max, you know, Max, I remember was on one of the original Fox soccer channels, like when you can get one game a week, that type of deal, or he was calling Argentine, like first division games, you know, he's been around, you know, there are a lot of people who have put their dues in who are just starting to get that recognition. And I'm not saying he's just starting to get his recognition, but it's good to see more voices and listen, it's good to see more Latino voices, but I'm just excited about voices in general, because for so long, it was, we're exposed to the Premier League. That's the league that you can get, the only league around, the only league that exists. So I grew up a United fan because that's what I was exposed to. I was exposed to the treble, you know, in the 90s. I used to VHS their games, not even DVR. I used to VHS their games.
Wow, dude, you're old, man.
Yeah, I am, you know. But it's the truth. Yeah, it's what you were exposed to. And now kids are being exposed to La Liga. They're being exposed to, you know, Ligue 1. They're being exposed to Liga MX. They're being exposed to Libertadores. You know, they're being exposed to MLS. I got to tell you what, part of the reason that I wanted to become a professional soccer player was because I got to go see an MLS game. It was the first time I had seen anything like this that wasn't on TV. And I saw it almost in my own backyard. There was a game at UNLV, and it was Kansas City versus Colorado. And I got to see two teams, and then I got to be within walking distance of these players, you know. So it when you see it's tangible, this is why I think MLS is great, because you can talk about the best leagues in the world and what these other leagues are doing, but there's nothing like being a child, being a kid, and it being tangible.
Yeah, I had a similar experience too. I was older at that point, obviously, with MLS being more prevalent in the late 90s. I got to be part of all the combines that took place down here in South Florida and met a lot of those players, met a lot of those youngsters that came up. But the game that just turned me around and said, hey, you know, this country has a great future was that Intercontinental Cup, Inter-American Cup match between DC United and Vasco da Gama. And DC United goes up to Fort Lauderdale and defeats Vasco da Gama, you know, 2-0. I was like, oh my God, you know, this is great. Oh my God, you know, the future here in this country is so bright just seeing that. But then, you know, it took more than, it's still, we're talking about 2 decades later and that things kind of change. But I mean, Herc, again, it's been so awesome to have you on. I want to switch gears because as far as you and how you've been able to say, one of the leagues you're obviously covering at ESPN is Liga MX. From the outside, how are you seeing Liga MX now? I mean, we've had all types of variations of it now with the 10-8 rule, now the 9-9 rule. How are you seeing the future there?
Well, let me start off by saying, in my perspective, it's the best league in the Americas. You know, the Brazilian league, the Argentine league, they're top heavy. They're a lot of holes in it. In the Argentine league, you know, it's just kids playing now. It's just kids playing. So the standard is there's some very good, but there's some very poor standard. These Liga MX teams are competing in European markets now for these players. They're competing in ways they haven't been able to do so, you know, before. The standard of player who plays in the league is a lot better. Yeah, you could say it's because of the influx of foreigners, but just because overall the resources they have are greater than most countries in Latin America. That said, if they don't change gears and the 9-9 rule, it's fine. You eliminated one foreigner, but the 9-9 rule is still way off where they need to be if they want to succeed as a nation. Now, one could argue you don't need the league to supplement the national team or to be that feeder system for the national team. But in a way they are. In a way they are, because the league owners, every single team ownership has a deciding vote in what happens
at the national team level. So in a way, they're in charge, or they're running things for the national team. So they should be worried, because sooner rather than later, it's going to be a trickle down effect, and those players aren't going to get minutes, first team minutes. Those players are going to be behind foreigners in key impact positions: goalkeeper, center back, center midfielder, you know, center forward. And you're not going to have that material. You're not going to have those players who can compete at high levels later on. And that's when your national team's going to hurt.
Yeah, and you're seeing it a lot in a lot of positions. I mean, especially up top, you do see, okay, well, is it going to always be Oribe Peralta? Is it going to be Gio for how long? Who's coming in behind those players to really make a difference? And you're not seeing that. Although, if you look at the under-20 side and you start looking at the players that have been able to come out of there, if you start looking even at the under-17s, you see some really talented players. Of course, the player that stands out in the whole youth system to me is Ariel Antuna over at Atlas. But, I mean, there's something lacking there. It's not like in Europe where you can, you know, have your entire team filled with European players and not have one Spaniard or one Italian or however you want to look at it, because of, you know, labor issues. But Mexico doesn't have that as far as foreigners are concerned. I think they're kind of hindering themselves to a certain extent. And now then you also have the other extreme, which is Chivas, who kind of, depending on how you look at it, they kind of have self-handicapped themselves by just signing domestic players. So you have both extremes when it comes to Mexican football. Well, which one do you see has a better future?
Well, I'll answer your first one. Mm-hmm. So Matias Almeida, which is the coach of Chivas, he was asked to talk about Mexico and the players and how he sees those players. And he said that when it comes to the U-17s, they're the best. You know, they compete with the best in the world, even the U-20s. He's like, you won a gold medal in the U-23s. He's like, but the problem for me is what happens in the process from 20 years old to 24, 25 years old, when these players should be getting first team minutes. So it's a situation where when you come to youth levels, they're better than all these other teams at a youth level. But when it comes to actually playing in that first division, you know, this should be getting into your prime level, they falter. They're stagnant. They don't have those minutes anymore. So that's it definitely hinders the national team. It hinders the Mexican product, especially like you said. Oribe Peralta is 34 years old. He's not going to be around for another decade. Chicharito, he's 28, going on 29. There isn't another Chicharito coming behind him. You need these players getting these first team minutes, you know, consistently, to get these opportunities with the national team to be effective going forward for the national team. Because if not, it's all going to come together, and you're going to have a very inexperienced group, and with inexperience come mistakes. So that could definitely hinder your performance down the road. Now, as far as Chivas is in a situation where, yes, they, you know, they're at a disadvantage. They handicapped themselves with only being able to sign Mexican nationals. Not only because they could only sign Mexican nationals, because now every other team around the league knows this. So their Mexican nationals that they're willing to send or sell you, they're going to overprice you for, because you really need them. So now you're inflating this market for the Mexican national player.
Kind of like England has done in the past.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, different context, of course, but still the means pretty much end up being the same. You know, the end to the means ends up being pretty much the same. It's just, hey, if they want him so bad, well, he's going to have to pay for him.
So that ends, you know, and it's case. Funny you bring up England. When I was in Pachuca, mm-hmm. Jesus Martinez, the owner there, and his ownership group would bring over this guy who was pretty much essential. I forget his name, but he was pretty much essential. He was one of the building blocks of the Premier League and all they had done. And they brought him over as a consultant to work with Pachuca and to work with, I'd assume, the Mexican Federation. But this is why many people are comparing Liga MX as the Premier League of Latin America. You know, they're going down that same route. And if you go down the Premier League route, you may have that Premier League success at some level, but you're also going to have a lot of those misfortunes at the national team level,
which England have had. So, I mean,
exactly.
Your point exactly. Juan Carlos Osorio, your thoughts on him?
I like him. I've had the opportunity and pleasure of interviewing him for for our podcast, Max and Herc, and he was a gentleman. He's very prepared, very educated. He loves talking the game. I really like the enthusiasm, the fresh perspective he brings to the game, and he's a breath of fresh air in Mexico. And the Mexican media, it's hard for them to deal with a person like this who doesn't necessarily want to talk about all these things in the exterior. He wants to talk about the game, so they find it difficult. And listen, he's a guy who has been under a microscope for one game. You know, that game against Chile in Copa America that they lost. He's not going to live it down. And every time he has a bad performance, even if they win, they're talking about getting rid of him because he's lost that one game.
They beat the U.S. Well, this next game might be Osorio's last game. It's mind-boggling.
He's in an improbable position, and it sucks because he's obviously a good coach. The players, you know, obviously enjoy playing for him. But he's in this position that's literally, it's either you win or you go home. There's no other way about it. And it's crazy to see because this is a country that really hasn't done much at the World Cup level.
I mean, like many say, you know, Mexico has won 120 million coaches. And it would be interesting to see if he does take him to that quinto partido, if he does take him to that fifth game in a World Cup. Ah, but you know what? Nah, he didn't play properly. Ah, no. That's not the way you play a quinto partido. It's like, well, because you guys have played so many in the past, you have a reference point as to how to play them. So, I mean, that's just, again, back and forth that I've had with some Mexican journalists at time. But he's just one of those guys that you don't know whether, you know, the media is going to get to him at one point or say, you know, I'm out of here. I'm done. But
yeah, but very realistic opportunity. You know, thing to happen. He's one of the better people I've spoken to about the game. His views on the game remind me a lot of Pedro Caixinha, and I really enjoyed playing for Pedro. Pedro was a guy who didn't play the game at a high level, but he had these fresh ideas on how the game should be played and how you should attack and defend as a unit. And very different to Mexican soccer. And it took a lot of people resisted when he got there. It took a while for them to warm up to him. But he's a guy who won over lots of the Mexican media. And I feel Juan Carlos could be the same. I just don't think Juan Carlos cares to do so. I don't think that's on his agenda. You know, he just wants to do the game.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I remember what you're saying about Caixinha. I mean, he took a lot of shit when he first took over at Santos Laguna. But I guess the results helped the media warm up to him. But I guess there's a big difference between coaching Santos Laguna and then, of course, coaching El Tri. So I think that's probably the big issue there for Profe. Last, and your greatest experience as a footballer.
Oh, that's easy. That's my 2010 year. I went from being out of a job and being told, you know, I wasn't very good. My value is such, take it or leave it, to taking a leap of faith, going down to Mexico and winning a golden boot, to making the World Cup, you know, getting to go to Pachuca and playing in the Club World Cup. That whole year was amazing. I did Golden Boot World Cup and Club World Cup in the same calendar year, and it changed my life. So that was, you know, I could sit here and say the World Cup is my single greatest achievement, but that year was just a roller coaster.
And you just mentioned the World Cup. I wanted to mention that, but of course everything else kind of started to take some. Tell me a little bit about that experience, about the whole, especially the Algeria game. I mean, tell me a little bit about what was going through your mind from your perspective, of course, and everything that was leading up there. And of course, the Landon's goal at the end, what was going through your mind saying, oh my God, we're going to get eliminated. What, you know, the whole process, even the England game, how did that go?
Well, now I'll tell you a quick little story about the England game. We're tied 1-1 and we're tied against England. I'm like, oh man, opening game tied against England, that's huge for us. You know, nobody gave us much of a chance in that group. It was England, Slovenia, and Algeria and us. And we were kind of seen as the ugly ducklings of the group. And we're tied 1-1 with England. And I'm thinking, we're going to get out of here with a tie. This is amazing World Cup. And they call my name. and I'm going to go on. And I'm pretty much thinking this is just to create time, you know, because it's in a stoppage time. I mean, this 90th minute when I was called onto the substitute table, and the ball doesn't go out of bounds for like 3 minutes. And I'm like, I'm about to get on a World Cup game. I'm about to get on, you know, come on, come on, come on. The ball doesn't go out. And finally goes out, and Clint walks over. And I myself am telling Clint to kind of like, hey, slow down. We want to make time. But just because that's what a sub's supposed to do, you know, at that point.
Yeah.
He's walking up. And as soon as Clint kind of high-fives me, before I even go in, the ref calls the game.
Oh, like, oh. I remember. Oh, my God.
And I was like, oh, man. But, you know, I'm so stoked. I'm so stoked to be there. And I had been kind of on a high of scoring goals off the bench at this point. So I kind of knew, like, sooner or later I'd get in. You know, and no problem. Steve Chirundolo is one of the first people to kind of run over to me. And Steve's, like, one of the best guys you'll ever meet in the game. Yeah. You know, great right back, mayor of Hanover, tons of years at the Bundesliga. He comes over, and he's like, Oh man, you almost got in. And I was like, yeah. And he goes, I got a story for you, but I'll tell you after next game. And I said, well, no, Steve, just tell me now. He's like, no, I'll tell you next game. And Steve, just tell me now. You know, we're still like on the field after the game. And he goes, well, same thing happened to me in my first World Cup, and I didn't get to go on. I was literally the same thing. And then the next day we trained, and I tore my ACL. And I was like, what? Steve, why would you say that to me?
Oh, no, great. Thanks a lot, man.
But don't worry. That's not going to happen to you. He said, don't worry. It's not going to happen to you. So long story short, next game, I come on at halftime. We're down 2-0. And
that's a slow game, right?
Yeah, and we ended up tying 2-2. And everybody's just like on cloud nine, and we're all having a good time in the locker room. And he comes up to me, beelines towards me, and he just looks at me and he goes, I told you that wasn't going to happen to you. So that was my – you know, England story. As far as the Algeria story, the Algeria game is when it hit me that I was playing in a World Cup. You know, they're building up this game as winner go home. Looking back on it, it was probably the biggest game the U.S. has had in a World Cup. One World Cup, you know, group, first time in its history, and I'm starting in this game now. So I'm walking out from the tunnel and the lineup, and we're going to do the national anthems. And it's, you know, when I have my hand over my heart, and I know it sounds cliche, and I'm singing, and this is when I kind of open my eyes and look at the crowd, and I realize how massive everything looks. For the first time in my life, everything looks massive, and then all of a sudden it hits me. I'm playing in a World Cup, and it was like, oh shit moment. Like, I'm playing in the World Cup.
Those old shit moments. I love how you put it, that which is phenomenal. But, I mean, is it just a second, or does it kind of, is it like a progressive, you know, kind of dissension from that moment, and you start coming back to reality? I mean, how does that go through your mind? How do those last minutes go through your mind?
It goes by so fast because you have no time. And this is the one thing I recall about the World Cup. Whatever time you think you have at any level, when you're in the World Cup, everything goes by so fast. And even those seconds of thinking, oh my God, I'm in a World Cup, they go by so fast. You're on to the next. By the time I knew it, you know, we're walking down, giving high fives to the Algeria players and get into our huddle and about to start the game. You know, it just goes by so fast, and then the game starts, and everything after the whistle blows is second nature. It is instinctive, and you react off of that.
And of course, everything that happened afterwards, you know, that goal by Landon Donovan, and I mean, I think there was like maybe like 3 seconds left in the match, and that whole situation occurs. That must have been like one of the most amazing moments that you were associated with in your career, without a doubt.
Yeah, you know what made it amazing? I mean, we were celebrating on the field. It was pandemonium after the game. We were just so excited. We got home, and all our like family and friends, they met us at the lodge, and there was like a big celebration, and that was cool. But it was when we started seeing the images of everybody back home in the States, and the reactions to people in bars, to people in restaurants, people in viewing parties, and how they went crazy, like, that was just, like, bone-chilling. Like, even to this day, just talking about it, you get goosebumps. It was insane. The reactions from people were just something like I've never seen, and that was what really made it cool.
Wow. I mean, that's phenomenal. Me, the closest experience was being in a bar with Adrian Healy. I was in Belo Horizonte, and I happened to run into Adrian Healy. We were watching the game with the entire ESPN crew at a bar there. It was the U.S. and Ghana, and there was some U.S. fans there, and then the whole place went crazy. It was just, you know, it was kind of cool to see that. You know, to me, it was one of the great experiences with U.S. fans and colleagues and stuff like that, people that I had respect, such as Adrian. That was great. I mean, but to hear it from you, that you were there, man, geez. I mean, to me, it's gold. To me, that's like, wow, you know. It just shows you that football, you know, the money, yeah, okay, but it comes down to being there, the experiences, the being able to say, hey, I did this and I was here. To me, that's just, you know, tremendously valuable.
It was definitely an experience that I'll definitely cherish. You know, it was exciting. It's still exciting to this day to just think of, you know, in general, what it caused.
Now, don't get too excited, okay? I mean, you know, you're gonna get all reminiscent. Oh yeah, this damn dude interviewed me, you know, and he's got me thinking about what happened. And yeah, no, okay. I just don't get too emotional on me. But I totally get it if you do. Herc, where can we find you? I mean, what else are you doing right now? I mean, obviously you're doing ESPN FC. You're doing a lot of Liga MX vignettes and things of the like as far as informing. Where can we find you? And more importantly, who do you think is going to win the Liga MX this year or this semester?
Well, listen, the thing is, I don't do one thing a lot. I do a lot of things all the time. So right now I'm actually doing a lot more Spanish these days than I'm doing English.
That's awesome.
In English, you can catch me on FC every once in a while. Sports Center with Max, I'll jump on and do the Bend It with the like Bretto segments on Sports Center with Max. And in my podcast, you know, Max and I really enjoy doing that. We get to talk about things that you probably normally don't hear on this side of the game. But in Spanish, I've been all over. I do regular segments on SportsCenter and Deportes. Sunday, Monday, I'll be out in LA and I'll be doing Nacion ESPN. So I'm getting a lot of different reps and invaluable kind of experiences that are hopefully going to be good. So you can catch me just on any ESPN channel. Honestly, it's all over the place. It's not like I'm doing too much, but I'm getting thrown around a little bit here, a little bit there, a lot. It's good.
That's a good thing, man. I mean, at least you're not just sitting in the bench waiting to be, I mean, to use, you know, figuratively, you're not just sitting in the bench and, hey, I'm here whenever you need me, I'm here.
Yeah. You know, it's been good. It's not too much, but it's a lot of different experiences, and you know, it's like, you know, this business, it's about repetition, like it is on the soccer field. You know, the more you do it, the more comfortable you are. So I'm trying to learn as quickly as possible, because there's still plenty I don't know. There's still plenty that I could improve on. So my mindset is, you know, to wear these different hats and get these different experiences that'll hopefully polish me up a little. And you know, as far as Mexico, I think this is Tigres to lose. Tigres, you know, Chivas today and then on Sunday, I think it's theirs to lose. I don't see how Chivas can stop that offense. I don't see how Chivas can score on that defense. I mean, Tigres has been dominant on both ends of the field. Chivas is going to have to do something really special. If they have any chance at doing something special, it's got to be in that first leg, because mm-hmm. Tigres have been putting teams away in that first leg.
Yeah, they really put them on their heels to begin with, and it's very, and when Tigres, a team like Tigres, has you you know, with your back to the wall, man, they really go after you in that second, that's, or at least they try to regulate, because you didn't see that as much in the Xolos return leg than you did compared to the obviously with Monterrey. It was a little bit more sanguine of a encounter. You know, Tigres really wanted to quash Monterrey and say, no, you're not coming back from this disadvantage. You are out. You're done. So long. We're just here for the trip. That's all. Meanwhile, with Xolos, it was more kind of like regulating the result and making the 90 minutes be as painful as possible for Xolos, like, if you want to look at it from that perspective.
I mean, Tigres is just that type of team. They can hurt you in so many different ways. I mean, that first leg against Cholos, Cholos literally started sitting in after they were down 2-0. When most teams would keep attacking, you know, Miguel Herrera was like, listen, listen, this is not going to get better for us. Let's try to take this 2-0 deficit, this two-goal deficit back home and try to revert things on our home turf. But you can't take those chances with Tigres. They're gonna make you pay.
And that's the genius of Tuca Ferretti. I mean, you know, especially, I mean, I don't know what's tougher for him right now. You know, being able to win the league or taking care of his little baby boy.
I mean, come on, he's the latter.
He's 63. He's got like a 6-month-old kid. I mean, you know, you got to give the guy props. Yeah, I mean, I'm just saying. I don't know, but anyway, Herc, man. Dude, we could probably talk about this all afternoon, all morning if we could, but I know you got things to do. Man, dude, thank you so much for being on. And, you know, hopefully, I think I'll probably be up there in Northeast sometime in the very near future. So I'll swing by and I don't know, I'll try and get your secret chilaquiles recipe so I can kind of, you know, be able to start the business down here. Because, I mean, it looks like, it, you know, the Mexican food you whip up, man, looks pretty good.
My wife whips up the chilaquiles. I do the carne asada, man. But oh, anytime you're down,
So I'm giving credit to the wrong person. Okay, okay. Tell the missus I said that her chilaquiles look just killer, man. I mean, okay. So I don't want to be misappropriating credit, okay? And your carne asada, okay. I'll take that too, man. I'll be more than happy to.
Sounds good. Well, whenever you're down here, man, you definitely got a beer with your name on it here.
Oh yes, I like that. I like that. And I like the expensive beers, just in case, you know. Okay, so make sure you take a good amount of money. Anyway, hey Herc, thank you so much, and I hope to have you back on. I hope to be around and really poke your brain a little bit when it comes to a lot of other things, all pertaining to MLS and also pertaining to Liga MX, sir.
Well, I really appreciate you having me, man. I had a lot of fun.
All right, man. Thank you so much.